For the final portion of readings from today's Richmond Times-Dispatch, we will return to your Virginia Voice readers, Steve Bush and Jenny Meeks.
Turning now for more news, our next article comes from page A7 and is headlined, Chief Administrative Officer and P-Cards Discussed at Richmond Mayor Forum, by M. Holter of the Richmond Times-Dispatch. Richmond's five mayoral candidates came together on Thursday evening to discuss future City Hall hires, the real estate tax rate, and city accountability. The candidate forum, hosted by the Richmond Crusade of Voters, welcomed a crowd of around 50 to the 3rd Street Bethel AME Church in Jackson Ward. Mayoral hopefuls Andreas Addison of the 1st District City Council member, Danny Avula, the former commissioner of the Virginia Department of Social Services, Michelle Mosby, former 8th District City Council member, Maurice Neblett, a community organizer, and Harrison Roday, a nonprofit executive and business owner, answered myriad questions posed by organization members. Here are some of the questions and responses. The question, would you keep the current Chief Administrative Officer Lincoln Saunders? Addison, no. Avula, I will do a national search for a new CAO, so no. Mosby, also no. Neblett, no. And Roday, I would not. While each candidate said they would replace the chief administrative officer, they all said they would retain current Richmond Police Chief Rick Edwards, with Neblett specifically commending his community engagement. Question, Richmond's real estate rate at $1.20 per $100 of assessed value is higher than neighboring counties at 81 cents to 92 cents per $100. If elected mayor, will you agree to reduce the city's real estate tax rate? Addison, our tax system is currently designed to punish homeowners. In my first budget, we will implement a tax reform that will shift how we tackle the property and the land. You will see us focus more on growth, where we want to see growth and create revenue. Avula's answer, we absolutely need to reduce the real estate tax here. This is a clear issue of competition in our region. We regularly lose residents who would love to stay in the city, would love to be part of the city that they grew up in. I don't think this is a day one initiative, because the reality is that we currently rely on that revenue for a lot of things, one of those being schools, so we will talk about competing priorities. Mosby's answer, I'm going to look at our tax structure, because not only is it our real estate taxes, but it's all of our taxes. I want to make sure that I'm making an informed decision as your mayor so that I can provide relief. When we're walking in the door as mayor, we at that moment are about to propose a budget. So we have to make sure that we are looking at our revenues and our obligations before we can truly say we're going to reduce the tax. Neblett's answer, I definitely believe we need homeowner retention. I definitely believe that not only do we need to reduce our real estate tax, you also need to look at how does that look to our seniors. As a community organizer, I see there's some seniors on fixed income, but then there's others that own their home, and they do not have any income. So not only for the real estate tax deduction, I would like to ensure that for our seniors, we do have programs and help preserve our legacy. And Roday's answer, I think it's really important that our next leader be someone who is straight up. It's going to be very difficult, if not impossible, to cut the real estate tax rate for every single person in the city of Richmond. It's our single largest source of revenue. We rely on it much more than other localities do as a percentage of our revenue, and we use that revenue to invest in critical priorities like funding our school system. So I think it's extremely unlikely that someone will be able to cut the real estate tax rate as much as we would like to do so. The next question, the city is currently in turmoil amid allegations of nepotism, cronyism, procurement violations, and improper use of credit cards. If elected mayor, how do you plan to right these wrongs? Addison's answer, as mayor, I will make sure you see where your tax dollars are being spent. For me, that starts with how we operate as a city, and for me, that's the thing it starts with, building your trust back to see the good work that good people do in City Hall all across the city every day cannot be mired by the few that are abusing the system, because that will not happen on my watch. Danny Avula's answer, so much of what needs to happen is accountability. Now, how does that happen in the public sector? You've got to train your managers and supervisors to know how to use progressive discipline and to know which offenses are immediately actionable. Michelle Mosby's answer, we've seen the P-card, we've seen the meals tax, we've seen all types of things happening. So at the end of the day, we need leadership that is going to be focused on accountability, that is going to be transparent. I understand what's going on because I'm focused on Richmond. We need to make sure that we're hiring in the next chapter that is going to be ensuring that accountability is a real reality, that transparency is a real reality, that they're not just buzzwords that we're seeing when we are running for office, but they are part of a lifestyle. Maurice Neblett's answer, do you know how many homes we could have had? I'm sure Petula Burks wasn't the only one. This has been going on for some time. This is something we need to face head on. It just comes down to being upfront, honest, and have integrity. That's what I plan to do. And Harrison Rode's answer to that question, here's one thing we're not going to do. We're not going to blame frontline workers in City Hall for this problem because actually they did their job. The folks who work in City Hall in procurement, they flag these transactions as problematic, and the people who were in charge didn't do enough about it. We have to have a leader who knows how to engage with financial statements, understand how our taxpayer dollars are being spent, and our frontline workers don't need to be distracted by these kinds of shenanigans. When asked what each candidate thought was the single biggest issue facing Richmond today, Addison said public safety, Avula said the potential displacement of residents as new people move in, Mosby said affordable housing, Neblett said the lack of trust and accountability in City Hall, and Rode said creating opportunity for residents. Polls are open for the Richmond mayoral election on November 5th from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m. Early voting begins September 20th. And that article from page A7 was the CAO, which is the Chief Administrative Officer, and P-Cards discussed at Richmond Mayor Forum by M. Holter of the Richmond Times-Dispatch. Jenny?
Thank you, Steve. And our next article is a local one on page A2. Black History Museum and Cultural Center of Virginia receives National Park Service designation. And it's by Leah Shepherd of the Richmond Times-Dispatch. The U.S. National Park Service awarded the Black History Museum and Cultural Center of Virginia with a designation in the African American Civil Rights Network, a collection of places and programs that tell the stories of the Civil Rights Movement. It is the second site in Virginia to be given the designation after the Contraband and Freedmen Cemetery and Memorial in Alexandria. BHMVA, located at the Lee Street Armory at 122 West Lee Street in Richmond, was founded in 1981 and has been headquartered in the historic building since 1991. The museum gives an overview of different time periods in Black history, including the antebellum period, the Civil War, Reconstruction, and the Jim Crow era. Additionally, the museum hosts exhibitions that feature more specific aspects of Black history and culture. The African American Civil Rights Network designation highlights our ongoing commitment to preserving and sharing the vital stories of the men and women who fought for civil rights and justice. This designation from the National Park Service, as well as the generous support from our donors, are powerful affirmations of our mission and the value of our work, said Shakia Gillette Warren, Executive Director of BHMVA. In addition to the new designation, BHMVA received grants from Dominion Energy and the Community Foundation of Richmond and a $200,000 anonymous foundation gift. This support not only strengthens our capacity to preserve and share African American history and culture, but also ensures that we can continue to grow and innovate. Our partnerships are essential in advocating for BHMVA and advancing our shared vision of a more inclusive and informed society, said Dr. Monroe E. Harris, Jr., the president of the board of BHMVA. The new funding will be used to transform the original site of the museum, which is on Clay Street, into a research center. Gullett Warren stressed the importance of preserving black history for the future. These funds will enable us to continue strengthening our museum as a center for scholarly research, making our extensive collection accessible to broader community and ensuring that our important stories continue to be preserved for future generations. And again, that local article on page A2, the Black History Museum and Cultural Center of Virginia receives a National Park Service designation, and it's by Leah Shepherd of the Richmond Times-Dispatch. Steve?
Thank you, Jenny. Our next local article comes from page A4, Plan to Streamline Regulations Sets Fiscal Year 2025 Targets, by Dave Ress of the Richmond Times-Dispatch. The work plan for Virginia's ongoing efforts to streamline regulations sets 455 targets for the fiscal year ending June 30th, ranging from a fresh look at standards for ice cream to revisions of several rules dealing with sewage and other pollutants that could flow into Virginia waters. The changes involve matters that touch some of the more obscure corners of life in Virginia, ending the requirements for a second weigh-in for boxers before a match, for instance, to services that affect tens of thousands of Virginians, like a new requirement that employers tell laid-off workers about the availability of unemployment insurance. Some are required by state laws enacted over the past few years, some by new federal mandates, and some by Governor Glenn Youngkin's executive orders and policy priorities. On the list is a look at easing the regulatory burden of complying with minimum standards for child care institutions, as well as a repeal of the rule that ground beef shall contain no more than 30% fat and shall not contain added water, binders, or extenders. Another proposal would remove the current requirement that classrooms for driving training school provide at least 10 square feet of space for each student. Yet another details programs that prisoners hoping to earn good time credit to reduce their time behind bars must participate in and requires them to demonstrate a desire for self-improvement. Others propose education and on-the-job experience requirements for specialists who delineate wetlands, often a critical issue when planning new housing or commercial developments, updating health standards for hotels, and new rules for tattoo artists. Our Office of Regulatory Management is following through on its commitment to transform and modernize burdensome regulations, making it easier for businesses to thrive, Youngkin said in releasing the work plan. A simplified and understandable list of all regulations will enable Virginians, companies, and interested groups to better participate in the regulatory process, he said. Reeve Bull, director of the State Office of Regulatory Management, said streamlining efforts so far have saved taxpayers more than $300 million a year without eliminating any necessary safety guidelines. And that article from page A4 was, Plan to Streamline Regulations Sets Fiscal Year 2025 Targets, by Dave Ress of the Richmond Times-Dispatch. Jenny?
Thank you, Steve. Our next article comes from page A3 under the heading of RVA 100, Exploring Hidden Histories. This story is the second installment of RVA 100, our series that highlights the people, places, and objects that define the Richmond region. We're exploring hidden histories and colorful backstories. Some will be familiar, others you may learn about for the first time. For 100 days, the Richmond Times-Dispatch will showcase a different quintessential Richmond icon in the newspaper and at richmond.com. Belle Isle, an integral part of the James River Park system. Likely the James River Park system's most famed and frequented area, Belle Isle is an island along the south bank of the river, across from downtown Richmond. A pedestrian bridge suspended under the Lee Bridge provides access from the Tredegar or Browns Island area to Belle Isle's wooded paths, mountain biking range trails, bicycle skills area, quarry pond, and scores of rocks ideal for sunbathing. The islands accompanying Hollywood Rapids render the water a favorite spot for kayakers, but dangerous for swimming. The island was acquired by William Byrd I in 1676 and remained in the Byrd family for a century. Open every day from sunrise to sunset, Belle Isle has over the years been home to a granite quarry, a nail factory, and an infamous Civil War POW camp. And again, this was part of a RVA 100 series, Exploring Hidden Histories, Belle Isle, an integral part of James River Park System, and it was by Zach Yoakum. Steve?
Thank you, Jenny. Our next article comes from page A12 and is Conditions Complicate the Battle Against California Wildfire by Ty O'Neill and John Antzak of the Associated Press. Dateline, Chico, California. Firefighters battling California's largest wildfire of the year prepared for treacherous conditions entering the weekend when expected thunderstorms may unleash fire-starting lightning and erratic winds that could erode progress made over the past week. Dry, hot conditions posed similar threats across the fire-stricken West. Weather, fuels, and terrain will pose challenges for the nearly 6,400 firefighters battling the park fire, which spread over 624 square miles since it allegedly was started by arson in a park in the Sierra Nevada foothills east of the Sacramento Valley city of Chico. It is now California's fourth largest wildfire on record. Suppression crews working on more than 200 miles of active fire front gained 24% containment by early Friday, Cal Fire said. Temperatures were expected to range up to 103 degrees Fahrenheit. The fire originated at low elevations, where it quickly burned through thick grass and oaks, destroying at least 542 structures and damaging 50 since erupting July 24th. As it climbed higher, the vegetation changed to a greater concentration of trees and brush, Cal Fire said. The fire's push northward brought it toward the rugged lava rock landscape surrounding Lassen Volcanic National Park, which was closed due to the threat. Lava rocks make for hard and slow work for hand crews, Cal Fire said in a situation report. Crews are being flown into access areas that have been hard to reach because of long drive times and steep, rugged terrain. After days of benign weather, increasing winds and a surge of monsoonal moisture were expected to increase fire activity and bring a chance of thunderstorms Friday night into Saturday, said Ryan Walbrun, incident meteorologist with the National Weather Service. The concern with thunderstorms is any gusty outflow winds that would push the fire itself or create some new fire ignitions within the vicinity of the park fire, Walbrun said. The collapse of thunderstorm clouds can blow wind in any and all directions, said Jonathan Pangburn, a fire behavior analyst with Cal Fire. Even if there's not lightning per se, it is very much a safety watch-out environment for our firefighters out there, Pangburn said. Walbrun said there was little prospect of beneficial rains from the storms, and the forecast for next week calls for continued warming and drying. As we look forward in time, we're really just entering the peak of fire season in California, he said. The Park Fire is among almost 100 large fires burning across the western U.S. Evacuation orders were in effect for 28 of the fires, according to the National Interagency Fire Center. Three wildfires burned Friday in Colorado near heavily populated areas north and south of Denver, with some 30 structures damaged or destroyed, thousands of people under evacuation orders, and human remains found in a destroyed house earlier this week. The Jefferson County Sheriff's Office disclosed Friday that a blaze threatening hundreds of homes near the Colorado city of Littleton was being investigated as arson. No further details were provided by Chief of Investigations Kevin Bost at a Friday news conference. Firefighters were making good progress on that fire despite the steep rocky terrain and blistering heat, and no houses were burned, officials said. The Federal Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives was investigating the cause and origin of a fatal blaze west of the town of Lyons, with specially trained fire investigators from the agency helping local authorities, agency spokesperson Crystal McCoy said. The area blackened by that fire remained relatively unchanged after it burned five houses. The largest of Colorado's fires, west of Loveland, grew to 13 square miles after previously burning about two dozen homes and other structures. Its cause is under investigation. Cooler weather was expected across the region Friday, with some scattered showers before hot, dry conditions return for the weekend. Scientists say extreme wildfires are becoming more common and destructive in the U.S. West and other parts of the world amid climate change and as droughts become more severe. And that article from page A12 was Conditions Complicate the Battle Against California Wildfire by Ty O'Neill and John Antzak of the Associated Press. Jenny?
Thank you, Steve. We might have time just to read a few Nation and World briefly articles on A16. TikTok. The Justice Department sued TikTok on Friday, accusing the company of violating children's online privacy law and running afoul of a settlement it reached with another federal agency. Hunter Biden. President Joe Biden's son, Hunter Biden, is set to be sentenced November 13th on felony firearm charges under an order a judge signed Friday. He faces up to 25 years in prison, but, as a first-time offender, is likely to get less time or avoid prison time altogether. Florida. A storm system brewing over Cuba on Friday will likely dump torrential rains over the Florida Peninsula this weekend, a forecast that's especially concerning for low-lying coastal and urban areas inundated by dangerous floods this year. Steve?
Thank you, Jenny. And that's all the time we have for reading today's Saturday, August 3rd, Richmond Times-Dispatch. I'm Steve Bush, along with
Jenny Meeks
for Virginia Voice. This program is brought to you by the generous support of the Richmond Times-Dispatch.